call.
I'd be fried.
You have stolen my dreams.
A green hydrogen powerhouse.
Let's talk about climate change.
Yeah, something new and different he's bringing to Radio National. Climate alarmism. I mean, honestly.
How dare you?
This is the last chance.
That's the intro to the Carbon Counter on the ABC's Radio National program. And the ABC is the Australian Broadcasting Commission. And this is the latest episode of Climate Conversations. And I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Now let's have a listen to The Carbon Counter in its entirety.
This is the Carbon Counter, my regular Monday look at a decarbonising economy. And the government has announced the creation of a net zero authority, which will hit the ground running from July this year. According to the brief, the authority will have the responsibility of promoting the orderly and positive economic transformation associated with achieving net zero emissions and to make sure no one gets left behind. Anna Scarbeck is the CEO of the not-for-profit Climate Works Centre. Welcome to RN Drive, Anna.
Hello.
It's interesting to see that this Friday, this announcement last Friday, has been broadly welcomed across different groups and lobby groups from the Australian Council of Social Services to the National Farmers Federation and to the Climate Council, to name a few. But with those many endorsements comes a pretty broad church of expectation. Does this new authority need to prioritise in order to be effective?
Well, it fills a really important gap, and that's why it has been welcomed by so many. There has been an enormous amount of research and collaboration across many sectors, as you mentioned. You mentioned the welfare groups, also the unions, the environment groups, the business council, and other specialist research groups and civil society think tanks. So the need for a national net zero authority arose because achieving net zero involves a need for a lot of coordination, and there's a lot of implementation to do. And so it's right for a national government to set this up, especially in an economy like Australia that has a federal government and state governments. But also it's right to give it three focus areas, and that's to support the workers in emissions-intensive areas. And it's also to coordinate the government policies and programs across many governments in those regions, and to coordinate with investors and the companies who will be doing much of the investment. And so this can be an investment attraction mechanism as well. And so there is a great need for a national authority like this, and plenty for it to do, but plenty of support for it to do that.
I mean, I don't want to be cynical, but we've all watched Utopia, and we know how, you know, bureaucracy can work. Will another layer of bureaucracy really help to achieve our target of net zero emissions by 2050? I mean, will the priorities be too split to satisfy its ambition?
This isn't another layer. It's rather a coordinating force for all of the layers. It can support the alignment of multiple different government programs with achieving a net zero goal. It can be the glue between many disparate programs that are actually all trying to solve for the same thing, often in the same place, but were set up at different times because this idea has been a long time coming. So there have been many other initiatives at state level. There are many local initiatives. And often what's missing is the roadmap that brings all of that together, a chance for the local, state and federal governments, plus the workers, plus the First Nations people, to actually convene together and agree that they are all chasing a common goal and they can write their own futures in a net zero economy. So that coordination piece is pretty powerful because it can unlock a lot of the busy work that might have happened anyway, but doesn't get the same effect when you don't combine it and align it to solve for the net zero goal.
So do you think in terms of, in practice, this authority will be able to sidestep or handle the kind of problems with the federated model? We've got energy being under a state remit, we've got emissions under a federal one. Will this create a better hotline between the two forms of government? Is that what it will do?
Yes, and also across all the different departments of government. Having a net zero goal is still a relatively new thing for national government. State governments have had net zero targets for years, and this year, this week, this budget is the first national budget week when there's been a legislated net zero goal. And achieving net zero emissions involves attracting new investment in new industries. It's attracting new support for R&D technologies, but it also involves supporting existing workers in the skills and education agenda. And it involves coordinating with international investors. And so the net zero goal touches nearly every department in each government. And that's why it's really powerful to have, firstly, to have the goal, to have a net zero target, and to have all governments aligning towards it, and to be able to have a net zero authority that can provide that concierge service that can connect to the existing programs, but also help identify the gaps and create support for the new ones when they're needed.
And is that what the $400 million industrial transformation stream will deliver, in your view?
Oh, that's just one piece of it. That $400 million is to help existing industries do some of the decarbonisation investment that's ready to go right now. There will be a lot more funding. There is already many other funding programs that can help support the net zero goal. There's a very large National Reconstruction Fund that's to support manufacturing in Australia, and much of that can be focused on helping Australia service a global net zero economy and build new industries. And there will need to be more investment. Our research that's looked at Australia's heavy industry shows that all of our mining and resources export strength can achieve net zero emissions in line with the Paris Agreement goals, but it would need to attract an additional hundreds of billions of dollars on top of the ordinary investment. International investors want to provide that investment, and our research shows that creates more than a million jobs in Australia. All of that needs really clear long-term policy signals and an easy ability to access government programs and services, but also an opportunity for the workers and communities in those regions where those new industries will be and where the existing industries need to modernise, a place where they can go to have their say and ensure that they are not left behind in this, but also that they can really prosper from these new opportunities.
Yeah, it's an interesting move and certainly a step in the right direction if we are going to achieve net zero by mid-century or earlier. Anna Skarbek is the CEO of the not-for-profit Climate Work Centre. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Those concerned about climate change are excited about decisions made in the latest Victorian state budget. A story from The Guardian explains that. The headline for the story is End of Native Logging in Victoria, a Monumental Win for Forests, say conservationists. The story is written by Adam Morton, Adshola Orr and Paul Karp. The story begins. Native forest logging in Victoria will end in December, 6 years earlier than previously planned, after the state government decided severe bushfires and legal campaigns had made it economically and environmentally unviable. The announcement by the Andrews Labor government in Tuesday's state budget follows a landmark Supreme Court judgment last November that the state-owned logging agency, Vic Forests, had broken the law by failing to protect endangered species. It triggered a shutdown of operations that contributed to Australia's last white paper mill located in Latrobe Valley, ending production of office paper in February. Government ministers said they had brought forward a previous commitment to phase out the industry by 2030. To deliver certainty to timber workers, sawmill operators and their communities. They pledged an extra $200 million in the budget as part of an $875 million transition support package for those affected. Conservationists celebrated the decision, which comes after decades of conflict over the destruction caused by clear-fell logging. In recent years, campaigners had brought more than a dozen court cases alleging loggers had breached forestry laws. Now we shift to the New Daily for a story by Matthew Elmas, and the story has the headline, Are Electric Vehicles Too Quiet? The government wants to know what you think. Matthew's story begins, a consultation process closing this week is asking Australians if they think EVs should be equipped with an acoustic alerting systems. due to fears they could be a hazard for pedestrians or cyclists. The technology would digitally mimic the sound of a combustion engine and play it through external speakers to better alert Australians when they're crossing the road or in a car park. Assistant Minister for Infrastructure and Transport, Carol Brown, said that while EVs have obvious environmental benefits, they can be difficult to hear, increasing the risk of collisions. Here is a short piece from 10 First News about electric cars.
When it comes to driving the roadmap of our manufacturing future, there are leading experts who believe the power lies in electric cars. Stakeholders believe jump-starting a mothballed industry could supercharge the sector.
Not that long ago, we made lots of them, and we made them well. A century of Aussie car manufacturing, gone with the stroke of a government pen. Now, a room full of some of the country's brightest minds reckon making future generations of electric cars for domestic and export markets is a no-brainer.
The level of passion for rebuilding Australia's manufacturing industry around cars is here.
We've done it in the past, and if we don't do it this time, it's a massive missed opportunity.
Speaker after speaker at this electric transport forum in Brisbane agreed Australia's currently an efficient and dependable provider of everything needed for the rest of the world's electric vehicle industries.
We've got to break that cycle of digging it out of the ground, doing some refining and then shipping it overseas and then buying back the products.
We absolutely could be a global, you know, superpower in this space for sure, especially because we've got all of the raw materials here.
Currently, plenty of government money's helped us lead the world in domestic and vehicle battery research and development, but calls for that to be redirected into a local electric car industry are growing louder.
Australia needs to make a decision about whether or not we're going to manufacture our new vehicles here, the electric vehicles in Australia, or if we're just going to wither on the vine and simply service imported cars into the future.
So we're great thinkers, but we're not great deliverers of manufacturing and industry outcomes.
Perhaps the time for doing as well as thinking has finally arrived. We've got the drive, now it's all about putting it into gear.
We just need good government industry policy to make sure that we deliver this on the ground.
And you'll find a link for that story in the show notes. Next, we have a paper from Nature Sustainability, and the headline for that paper is, or the title for that paper is, Quantifying the Human Cost of Global Warming. The abstract begins, the costs of climate change are often estimated in monetary terms, but this raises ethical issues. Here we express them in terms of numbers of people left outside the human climate niche, defined as historically highly conserved distribution of relative human population density with respect to mean annual temperature. We show that climate change has already put 9% of people, that's 600 million, outside this niche. By the end of the century, 2080 to 2100, current policies leading to around 2.7 degrees Celsius global warming could leave one-third, that's 22 to 39% of people outside the niche. Reducing global warming from 2.7 degrees to 1.5 degrees Celsius results in a five-fold decrease in the population exposed to unprecedented heat, a mean annual temperature of 29 degrees Celsius. You'll find a link to that paper in the show notes. Next, we have an audio story from AM on Radio National ABC, which is the Australian Broadcasting Commission, and host Sabra Lane talks with scientist Edward Doddridge. The story is headed, Gobsmacking, Antarctic Sea Ice Shrinks. You'll find a link for the story in the show notes, but here is this little piece now.
We're just a month away from the winter solstice, the longest night of the year in the Southern Hemisphere, and Antarctica, that means constant darkness with no direct sunlight for about a month. During that period, the sea ice around the continent would be growing, but it's different this year. In some areas where the sea ice should be expanding, it's declining. To help understand why, I spoke with Edward Doddridge from the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania.
It is a mind-bogglingly fast reduction in something that we thought was quite a stable climate index. So the amount of sea ice around Antarctica has been stunningly resilient to climate change for years and years now. But we have just had three record low summers in the last 7 years. Two back-to-back. It's gone lower than anyone thought it could. It has all happened extremely rapidly. It is gobsmacking.
We're a month away from the winter solstice. What does it suggest to you?
It's extremely unusual. So the areas where we've seen ice declining this year, in particular in the Bellingshausen Sea in the last week or so, there's been a strong, persistent northerly wind. And normally, when you have a northerly wind in the wintertime, it forms more ice and that ice piles up against the coast. But this year, we've seen just no ice in that region at all, which is extremely surprising and really worrying. And it suggests that something has changed around Antarctica. Perhaps the ocean has been warming. This might be the sort of long consequence of climate change finally coming to the fore around Antarctica.
Reporter Nick Toscano has a story in the Melbourne Age that has the headline, Australia can still meet climate targets if it spends billions more. His story begins, Australia is on track to have one of the most diversified and lowest carbon electricity grids in the world. But new modelling shows more aggressive spending on renewable energy, carbon capture and hydrogen is needed to keep the nation's 2050 net zero emissions target alive. In its latest Outlook report for Australia, energy research firm Bloomberg NEF's base case scenario, what it considers the most probable and least cost outcome based on current climate policies, charts that wind, solar and batteries will grow 6.5 times on today's levels by 2050. As the country's aging fleet of coal and gas-fired generators face intensifying economic pressures. Let's have a listen to Laura Chung talking about turning off a power station.
No doubt you've heard a lot about the phase-out of coal as Australia tries to reduce its emissions. But how do you actually decommission a coal-fired power plant? It's not easy, and it's taken electricity giant AGL 7 years to come up with a plan. Later this month, they'll be turning off the Liddell Power Station, which sits in the Hunter Valley region, and it's been operating for 52 years. There's three main stages to decommissioning a coal-fired power plant. The first one is turning off the station, cleaning and drying the equipment. This takes about 6 months to complete. Next, you take apart the power station. This includes the two giant columns that sit outside Liddell and the main structure itself. This takes about 2 years to do. The third and final step is levelling the site using crushed concrete and preparing it for its new life. In the case of Liddell, we're likely to see a low-carbon industrial energy hub. So this means large batteries, solar, wind and hydro projects might pop up. But let's take a step back. How do you turn coal into electricity? In simple terms, coal-fired power stations produce electricity by burning coal in a boiler to produce steam. This steam is then spun in a generator which produces the electricity. The steam is then cooled and condensed back into water, pushed back into the boiler, and the whole process starts again. But the big question on everyone's lips is, will we still have power? Because Liddell has given the market 7 years of notice, we've been able to prepare for the closure of that power plant. But as more and more coal-fired power stations switch off, experts say that we need to increase our investment in renewable energy projects. We need to almost double our current pace of investment to meet the government's targets of 82% renewables by 2030.
And yes, you'll find a link for that story in the show notes. Next, we have a story from The Conversation, and this one has the headline, After the Chainsaws, the Quiet. Victoria's rapid exit from native forest logging is welcome and long overdue. The story begins, by the end of the year, Victoria's trouble-plagued native forest industry will end. 6 years ahead of schedule. The state's iconic mountain ash forests and endangered wildlife will at last be safe from chainsaws. There'll be no shortage of wood. There's more than enough plantation timber to fill the gap. Tuesday's announcement by Premier Daniel Andrews is excellent news for the forest, the state's economy and threatened species. We congratulate the Victorian government for this decision. The story is written by David Lindemar, who is a professor of the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University, and Chris Taylor, who is a research fellow at the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the same university. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations, and you'll find links to all those stories I've mentioned in the show notes, along with many, many others. Because I can't fit them all in, well, I can't comment about all of them, so I just put the links in the show notes. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. So I urge you to take care and be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And please, if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it with your friends. In fact, I implore you to share it with your friends, because we all need to know all we possibly can about dealing with the climate crisis and how we should respond. Beyond that, I'd love to hear from you, so you can contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com. And there's just one more thing. I urge you to follow this podcast, and if you do that, you'll be automatically alerted every time I publish a new episode. So until we talk again, please take care.